You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, thousands of deer and other wild animals die on Wisconsin roads each year. We'll hear how specially designed overpasses can help keep animals and drivers safer. Now, the world's first ever FDA-approved mRNA vaccine came out last year, the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine. Our next guest has been studying mRNA and other gene-based vaccines for decades. She says the possibilities of these kinds of vaccines are enormous, with the potential to treat HIV, autoimmune disorders, and some kinds of cancer. Deborah Fuller is a professor of microbiology and the division chief of infectious diseases and translational medicine at the National Primate Research Center at the University of Washington. Deb, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it seems like mRNA technology for a lot of us was new with these COVID vaccines, but you and others have been researching this technology for a long time. Can you tell us about the research that may have been under the radar for most of us?
Yeah, research started over 30 years ago. Actually, a lot of research in mRNA vaccine technology started right at the University of Wisconsin there. So I actually lived in Wisconsin for almost 20 years and did a lot of my initial research there. But a lot of it got started many years ago just with the idea that if you could get a genetic material into our cells, RNA in particular, and instruct our cells to make proteins, that those proteins could lead to induction of immune responses against those proteins. So that was sort of the concept of vaccines, but at the same time, we had always been thinking about them for other uses, like for gene therapy or for cancer immunotherapy. And so all this work has been going on for a period of about 30 years, even before SARS-CoV-2 hit us.
Talk a little bit more about how the mRNA works in the vaccine setting, if you would, before we get into some of these other treatments that are maybe in the works.
Absolutely. So mRNA actually codes for protein, and that protein would be, in this case, a protein from the virus itself. In this case, for SARS-CoV-2, it was a spike protein. And so the way RNA vaccines work is that you inject that genetic material into the body, it gets carried into the cells, and then it instructs the cells to start producing that protein. So it's like your own body becomes your own vaccine producer. So your cells are producing the vaccine antigen, and then once that's produced, your immune system can see that and start generating antibodies against that protein. Once those antibodies are made, those are going to be circulating in your blood and be able to protect you should you get exposed to SARS-CoV-2. So that's with SARS-CoV-2, but we've been working on that for many other infectious diseases even before the pandemic struck, like, for example, for HIV and for influenza, because we thought the next pandemic was actually going to be flu, and it turned out to be coronavirus. One of the beautiful things about RNA vaccines and very closely related DNA vaccines is that they can very quickly be pivoted to address really any infectious disease. So while we were working on HIV and influenza, when the pandemic struck, it was very easy for us, once they knew the sequence of the spike protein, to simply replace out the sequences for HIV or influenza and insert them into our RNA platform and then be able to inject that into people. And voila, you have a COVID-19 vaccine.
And Deb, with HIV in particular, my understanding is it is a virus that's a very hard target for vaccinations. People have been working on this for a long time. Where are we now? What kind of promise does mRNA have for an HIV vaccine?
There's a huge amount of promise. So as you mentioned, HIV is a big, big challenge. In many respects, SARS-CoV-2 was a low bar compared to HIV, which is a very, very high bar, not only because of its level of diversity, but because when that virus gets in your body, it goes latent and it can sit in your cells for a long period of time and hide from the immune system. So that has created a lot of challenges for researchers to develop an HIV vaccine. Now, recently, Moderna has started a phase 1 human clinical trial of a very promising HIV vaccine that is built on this idea that what you would do is expose the body to different antigens that represent different HIV variants and allow the body to develop these broad neutralizing antibody that could potentially protect you against any HIV variant that comes along. Now, they just started that trial, and prior to mRNA vaccines, that would be somewhat of a complicated vaccine, because what it requires is that you basically boost people with very different vaccines, somewhat differently modified vaccines, to develop their immunity. But if you're going to make a protein-based vaccine or traditional vaccine representing each one of those, that becomes almost logistically a nightmare to do. But with mRNA vaccines, because they're so simple to update and to change, you can very readily be able to immunize people with this sort of series of different exposures to different HIV antigens to induce that response. So we're very optimistic that this is this might be really a promising approach for HIV vaccines.
Talking to Deborah Fuller, microbiology professor, formerly here in Wisconsin, now at the University of Washington, talking about the prospects for vaccines and treatments using mRNA technology. You mentioned cancer earlier, and correct me if I'm wrong. If I understand it correctly, this wouldn't be a cancer vaccine necessarily, but a way to use mRNA to help treat people who have cancer already. Do I have that right?
Yeah, well, it's both, actually. Let's talk about the treatment first. Because that's really what's in clinical trials right now and has been actually even before the COVID-19 vaccines. There were already mRNA vaccines being tested in humans for treatment of cancer. So what happens in cancer is that we get these aberrant cells that become, look like they're going to be cancerous. And normally what happens is that when a cell kind of changes and becomes more tumor-like, our body recognizes that as not being normal and will eliminate that. That's what happens in a normal situation. What happens when we get cancer is that our immune system doesn't quite recognize that altered cell, and that cell then is allowed to grow into a tumor. So what mRNA vaccines are trying to do is actually stimulate in a person who already has cancer that immune response that's in our body that's capable of finding those tumor cells and eliminating them from our bodies. So how does it do that? When a cell becomes cancerous, it starts to produce these sort of new antigens. They're different from normal antigens. We call them neoantigens. And when those are produced, we can actually pull out the cells from somebody who might have cancer and actually sequence what is that neoantigen, what is it producing. And once we've identified that, that can be inserted into an mRNA vaccine, injected into that person, and then that person will better be able to make immune responses against that neoantigen, which is presented on the cancer cell. Once you have immune responses against a neoantigen, your body will see that tumor cell much more efficiently and hopefully be able to eliminate it more effectively.
I wanted to take a minute to talk about autoimmune disorders. I think for a lot of people, a very frustrating condition that doesn't seem like there's lots of treatments for. Can you take a minute to talk about what mRNA could do?
Yeah, it's sort of almost an opposite thinking in a way. We've been talking all along here about cancers and infectious diseases that we're always trying to use the mRNA vaccines to stimulate and activate an immune response to eliminate an infection or eliminate a cancer cell. In autoimmunity, we want the opposite effect, because autoimmunity is like an overactive immune response against our own self proteins. We're attacking ourselves with our immune system, basically. And so what an mRNA vaccine that is structured as more of an autoimmune sort of to suppress autoimmunity is that we alter some of the sequences in such a way that instead of stimulating and activating an immune response, we activate other types of immune cells in our body. They're called regulatory immune cells, and they function to dampen our immune system. And so if we can activate those to specifically target immune cells that are attacking our own cells, our own proteins, then we can actually dampen the immunity and suppress the autoimmune reactions in our body.
Well, Deb, we'll leave it there. Thanks for taking us on a tour of this technology.
Yeah, my pleasure.
That's Deborah Fuller, professor of microbiology and division chief of infectious diseases and translational medicine at the National Primate Research Center at the University of Washington. She talked to us today about the future potential of mRNA vaccines and treatments. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about a chance encounter with a squirrel.
When writer Ron Weber decided to go for a walk on a pleasant January day, he encountered an unexpected companion. Their shared journey was both amusing and inspiring, offering Weber a thoughtful reflection on the importance of play.
I opened my jacket as I walked, odd for midwinter, but the warmth of a January thaw was welcome. I decided to grab a quick snack as it was pushing noon. Munching on mixed nuts, I caught a glimpse of movement up ahead. A gray squirrel, a portly fellow who looked as though he had taken his task of fattening up for winter seriously, entered stage left. He rummaged through the softening snow until he reached a large basswood and promptly scurried into the treetop. My eyes followed him from one branch to the next, passing into a neighboring ash. By the next tree, I had joined the squirrel on his journey. I scanned the branches ahead, trying to anticipate our next move. Though a few times I got it right, my guide often had other ideas. I trusted his judgment on such things, so on we went. The fifth treetop looked like the end of the line. There was a 2-foot gap to cross to reach the next tree. That appeared to be the least of our problems. The closest branches on each tree looked like they would have a hard time supporting a chickadee, much less a 2-pound squirrel. It was a fun ride while it lasted. I imagine in squirrel school, pupils learn that traveling in the treetops is safer than on the ground, where predators await from there and above. The curriculum, I would hope, must also cover the physics and limitations of treetop travel. Much to my surprise, or shall I say horror, he started shimmying out onto the branch. He laid out flat like someone trying to get off thin ice and began inching forward. Then, much to my delight, with the flick of his tail, he backed up and got onto a thicker part of the branch. I thought he had finally come to his senses, but in a flash, he simply dropped down to a lower part of the same branch and again crawled out toward the end. I knew then he had no intention of backing away from this challenge. He was going to jump. Sir Isaac Newton clearly stated in his third law of motion that for every action force, there is an equal and opposite reaction force. I had seen this demonstrated many times, most applicable to this situation, by a friend who tried to jump from our boat onto the dock. But as he pushed off the boat moved further away from the dock, and he came up short and in the drink. I was hoping my newfound friend hadn't slept through science class and mislearning this important tenet of science from the headmaster squirrel. In an instant, he was in midair. He sailed across the chasm, grabbing the thin branch of the next tree. The branch swung down, and like Tarzan on a vine, he rode the branch forward, letting go at the perfect time, his momentum carrying him to a sturdy part of the branch. A human pulling off such a feat would be jumping up and down and taking a selfie. My buddy, without a bow, tail wag, or paw pump, kept right on going. Two more treetops, and we reached an oak in which an uprooted basswood was wedged. He used this to make his way back to terra firma. I was back down now too, and with a flick of his tail as if to say goodbye, he exited stage right. After watching so many animals, I know fun and play are important to them. I want to believe that other than the practical reason of safe travel, he had gone on this journey for the fun of it. I was glad he had taken me along.
Ron Weber is a writer and forester who lives in Weyerhaeuser. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, we'll hear how roads could look different here in Wisconsin when they're designed with wildlife safety in mind. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Around 12% of wild mammal deaths in North America are caused by roadway crashes. That's according to research done last year. In some cases, roads cut off animals from migrating in winter. A form of infrastructure called wildlife crossings can help animals bypass those roads. Currently, only about 1,000 of them exist in the United States. Patricia Kramer is an independent wildlife researcher who's worked with the Department of Transportation and state wildlife agencies. She recently talked to WPR's Lee Rayburn.
Patricia, you've studied each state's data on car accidents involving wildlife. What did you find out specifically about Wisconsin and how it compares with the rest of the country?
Sure. Wisconsin, I looked at 5 years of crash data from your Department of Transportation through 2019, and Wisconsin averages over 20,000 reported crashes with wildlife each year. And that winds up being 16% of all your crashes. That's actually quite large. Most states have the number of recorded crashes with wildlife are well under 10,000. And the average of all the states is about 5% of all their crashes are with wildlife. So you very much have a problem there in Wisconsin.
I think anecdotally, we can all see it as we're driving down the roads at one point or another. But how are U.S. roads affecting animal interactions with the environments around them then, Patricia?
Well, as you see, roads can be pretty lethal because of the traffic on them killing the animals. They also create habitat fragmentation for the animals. We can see how a deer can't get to the other side of the road to access water or food. But there's also smaller animals like salamanders trying to migrate to a pond to lay eggs, or turtles, or black bear. Bear are known to be a bit more skittish of roads than other species of animals. So you may have your black bear restricted to one side or the other. So there's the ability to get to your kitchen, your bedroom, your backyard. For all these animals, if they're in an area with roads, those places are bisected with a bunch of vehicles coming through. So it affects the individual animals that you see, but then over time it can affect the populations, and you can lose those populations of animals.
Patricia Kramer, our guest, wildlife researcher. And Patricia, it was in the mid-90s that I came across wildlife crossings for the first time. It was actually a frog tunnel in Davis, California. And I'm wondering what your research says about their effectiveness.
Oh, well, wildlife crossing structures work, and I will encourage anyone who doubts it or would like to see them in action, if you would go to YouTube and type in the words wildlife crossings. We do research here. Well, actually, I'm all over the country, but I have videos online for Utah wildlife crossings and Montana wildlife crossings, and you can see dozens to hundreds of animals, particularly deer, going through structures. There's also great videos by others showing some of the smaller animals, even down to groundhogs or squirrels going across structures, porcupine, skunks, moose. I even have photos of wolves using structures in Montana. So they very much work. If anyone is a naysayer, it's because they're not informed. But we know they work. There are some animals that are skittish. For instance, pronghorn, bighorn, and elk are the problem children. And you can get a couple of the boys to go through, but to get a herd of all of them with the matriarchs leading, they're very skittish, and we typically have to put in overpasses for them because they don't like to be restricted in their movements. And so what we do in our research with wildlife is we put cameras on the entrances to a lot of these structures and even existing bridges and culverts, and we see who goes through and who's skittish and doesn't want to. And then we compare the results and we tell the engineers, okay, length matters, which means don't make it a long, dark tunnel. Keep it high and wide and open, and you'll get a lot more of the animals. So they very much work for the animals they're designed for.
So the benefits for the animals and the animal population, quite clear. But what does the data say about what we've seen in terms of benefits for humans and our transportation systems?
So I went and added up the cost, the average cost of all the crashes that are reported with wildlife in Wisconsin, and it's over $263 million worth of crashes. So that's property damage, people's injuries, and the value of human lives lost. So if we put wildlife crossings in along with some fences to guide these bigger animals like your white-tailed deer, less people will get in crashes, less people will die, people will save money, maybe your insurance rates would go down. And you might be less fearful going out at dawn and dusk when these animals are out and about. So it winds up being a great win-win situation for everyone.
So, Patricia Kramer, if this is a win-win situation for everyone, why aren't there more of these crossings across the United States?
Well, because Departments of Transportation have evolved just providing transport for goods and services and people. And their mission statements do not say too much about the environment, connectivity for wildlife, you know, ecological reasons for doing things. And so we are asking Departments of Transportation to do something they haven't typically considered, and they have to say, well, there's many things we have to consider. So my mission in life is to change the mindset for them to do things that not only benefit wildlife, but will help the transportation department minimize crashes, so the safety aspect, as I've been saying, but also things like, okay, you need to plan for climate change and the water coming through a place like Wisconsin, the runoff in the spring is going to be in greater pulses, greater volumes. And so you need to be planning not just for culverts for water, but placing bridges that encompass more than the 100-year floodplain. And in turn, that will protect the infrastructure from being washed away by the flooding that might happen with climate change. And you might have terrestrial pathways along the stream that now the animals can use, and even people that are anglers can walk along underneath the road and don't have to pop up over it because it was just a culvert. So there's many small things you can do. And then when a big project comes along, like, say, four-laning a two-lane highway through a national wildlife refuge or a place where there's a lot of animals, we try to encourage the inclusion of wildlife crossing structures early in the planning. That is so critical, not 5 years down the line, but 15 years down the line, saying, hey, let's put in some bridges for wildlife to get underneath the road. So it's multifaceted working with the transportation departments to consider this, which would save them money and make your road safer for you.
Patricia Kramer, thank you for sharing your research with us.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for your interest.
That was wildlife researcher Patricia Kramer talking to WPR's Lee Rayburn. They talked about wildlife crossings and how they could help animals in Wisconsin ecosystems. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, if you felt like you were just getting by during the pandemic, you're not alone. Look at the psychology behind what some people call survival mode, how we live with it, and how we can break out of it. And the surprising hit game Wordle is just the latest in a long line of word games, puzzles, and brain teasers to capture the public imagination. We want to hear your favorites and why you like them. You can start the show right now. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know your crossword habit if you've jumped on the Wordle bandwagon and why. Again, let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then the pandemic has caused a lot of us to feel lonely. So how can we overcome that? We'll hear from a researcher who says the key may be in how we respond to our own negative thinking. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a political scientist who's a former Olympian explains the political controversies surrounding the upcoming Beijing Olympics. First, when you feel lonely, what are some of the thoughts that run through your head? Maybe you blame yourself for feeling lonely, or you focus over and over on the thing that made you feel lonely in the first place. For a lot of us, those thoughts can easily spiral. But our next guest says with a few simple steps, there may be a way to feel better that helps us reconnect with others again. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When have you felt lonely during the pandemic? If you're working remotely, do you miss seeing people in person? Have you felt the impact of seeing your friends and family less over these nearly 3 years? How do you cope with loneliness when that feeling comes up for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Amit Goldenberg is an assistant professor of business administration at the Harvard Business School. He's a psychologist by training and one of the researchers behind a number of recent studies on loneliness. Amit, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
I know loneliness has been a concern in the United States for some years. What kind of impact have you seen the pandemic having on loneliness?
Yeah, you know, this is a very interesting question because there are a lot of studies. The intuition is that pandemic has dramatically influenced loneliness throughout the U.S. But actually, when you look at empirical data, the lines seem to be quite flat, which is we don't see a huge effect of the pandemic on loneliness. That feels weird, right? Mm-hmm. So we have to look under the hood. And when we do, we see that for some people, The pandemic has actually decrease their loneliness for various reasons. You know, some people had to spend a lot of time with others who are close to them, which made them feel less lonely. While others, and that's the thing that we sort of most intuitively connect to, feels lonely because they can't have social connections. And so generally speaking, the general trend is unclear, but if you look under the hood, I think it's clear that a lot of people are feeling a lot more lonely than before.
And we should be clear, loneliness is more than just being alone. You could be alone and enjoy solitude. That isn't the same thing as loneliness. Can you talk about kind of the definition of that negative impact of loneliness?
Yeah, that's right. So we need to differentiate or to think about two things. One is social isolation, which is being alone. And the other one is the experience of loneliness, which is a complex set of feelings that occur when intimate and social needs are not adequately met. And you already see the difference. One is sort of an objective measure of how alone someone is, and the other one is a subjective measure of how much one feels that their social needs are met. And the correlation between the two is surprisingly low. We have a lot of people who are completely alone but don't feel lonely. And we have a lot of people who have intimate relations, they have family, they live with other people in the house, they have a lot of friends, yet they feel lonely all the time. And so it's really important to differentiate between the two things.
You've been part of this really global study looking at a particular technique for dealing with not just loneliness, but other negative emotions as well. Let's talk about this idea of reappraisal. What is that?
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes our emotions are unhelpful. And in these cases, we may want to change these emotions in a way that will help us deal with all sorts of social situations and others. But and there's various strategies to do so, right? I mean, if your boss is making you angry, there's all sorts of ways that you can deal with that. And all of these ways fall under the umbrella of emotion regulation, changing how one feels to achieve some kind of a goal. But it turns out that not all emotion regulation strategies are as helpful or as healthy. For example, one unhealthy, or in most cases, unhealthy emotion regulation strategy is to suppress that emotion. So if we think about my example of a boss being making one angry or feeling lonely, suppressing that emotion, not expressing it, has shown to be a very unuseful way to reduce emotion. In fact, when we look at people's brains or physiology, when they suppress their emotions, it actually seemed to be that their emotion seems to be stronger than when they're not doing it. Now, one very useful way to change one's emotion, as research suggests, and we have research for many years about this sort of strategy, is what we call reappraisal, which is changing the way one thinks about the situation in a way that makes you feel differently. So giving the example that I've had earlier with the boss, this would be you thinking, well, you know, usually my boss is not generally sort of an aggressive or unpleasant person. Maybe there's something going on in their personal life that makes them be especially sort of aggressive today, for example. Now, this seems very simple, but there's a lot of complexity here, because there's all sorts of ways to do reappraisal. And you could test people's ability to do reappraisal on a variety of levels. So for example, we know that people who frequently use reappraisal in their daily life tend to feel better, tend to form better social interactions, tend to be healthier. So this sort of seemingly simple strategy may have a huge effect on how people carry themselves in their lives. And so we wanted to test whether this is true for things related to the pandemic, and we conducted a global study with 24,000 people across 87 countries and regions around the world, and we trained them to do reappraisal, and we taught them how to do it. and compared them to some other strategies that we thought would do better, would do less good than reappraisal. And indeed, we found that it had a tremendous effect on people's, in reducing people's negative emotions and specifically loneliness in the context of the pandemic.
We're talking to Amit Goldenberg with Harvard Business School, psychologist there, part of a global study, as he was just mentioning, on how we deal with our negative emotions and finding surprising results in helping relieve, helping cure, maybe, loneliness. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had a lonely stretch in your life? Have you had to deal with problems of loneliness during the pandemic that you didn't have to before? Or, as some people, as we heard, vice versa. Did you feel less lonely during the pandemic? Do you have a question about how this sort of reappraisal technique of our negative emotions can work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Amit, we'll get into maybe some more practical strategies of how we can do this kind of reappraisal, but I think this might surprise a lot of people. I think we might think of being lonely, of loneliness, as a state of being rather than a consequence of our emotions, right? It's the cause of the problems, not something that we could solve getting into our emotions. Can you connect the dots for us a little more?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Loneliness, the way I think about loneliness is this sort of vicious cycle that could start in various locations. But one idea is that let's start with actually the experience of loneliness. One feels that their social needs are unmet because they see other people on social media that seem to have a better or more rich social life than they do, or because they truly are alone and have no one to sort of talk to sort of on an intimate level. This contributes to sort of all sorts of maladaptive social cognitions of other people. And generally speaking, sort of negative perceptions of other people, being more suspicious towards other people, which leads to difficulty to form connections, which leads to social isolation. And you can already see how this vicious cycle can sort of unfold over time and lead to more and more loneliness.
So how would we start to use this reappraisal then? One negative technique is that you also write about in the study is blame of myself or others. I'm lonely because there's something wrong with me, or I'm lonely because there's something wrong with everybody else. Those are two systems, I think, if I understand your research, that don't help. How would I approach loneliness via reappraisal?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So I should say the reappraisal cannot always be helpful. I mean, you can reappraise situations in a way that will make you feel even worse, right? If you're lonely and you say, wait, everyone around me seems to be having a rich life and happy, and I'm sitting here at home and no one to interact with, that's a form of reappraisal that is likely to lead to sort of more negative outcomes. But generally speaking, positive forms or helpful ways to reappraise, that you could think about them in two ways. One is trying to sort of think about positive aspects of the situation in a way that would make you feel better. So it's almost like making lemonade from lemons. So, you know, this is a pandemic. I'm sitting at home and I'm completely isolated because I can't forum. But actually, I have some family members who are with me, and that's a really interesting opportunity and good opportunity to strengthen my connections with the people that are close to me or in my household. That's one example of reappraisal. Another one is to take a step back from the situation and try to look at things on a broader level. Yes, you know, I may be lonely right now, but, you know, there's all sorts of ways that I can do to help me. And maybe this is a temporal situation. Maybe this is sort of a circumstantial situation that I'm at, but there's all sorts of ways that I can change that. And there's ways who people have shown to be useful. So you see how these sort of thought processes that are sort of helping us to reduce our negative emotion and help us in some ways to sort of get up and change our lives in ways that will make us feel better eventually.
Talking to Amit Goldenberg. He studies emotions and emotion regulation at the Harvard Business School. He's with us today to talk about his recent research into loneliness and strategies for coping with loneliness. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had a lonely stretch in your life, maybe during the pandemic or before? are there strategies? Are there things that help you feel better when you're feeling lonely? Can you find the silver lining in hard situations? Have you done, maybe even without knowing what it was, the kind of reappraisal techniques our guest is talking about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about research on how to combat loneliness. Amit Goldenberg with the Harvard Business School stays with us, a psychologist who's participated in a global study on negative emotions, how to deal with them, including loneliness. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your own experiences with loneliness at some point in your life. Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Tom is with us in Green Bay. Tom, hello.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I have a question for you. I'm an alcoholic, and at the end of my drinking, I could be in a crowded room and feel very, very lonely. Now I can be out on a trout stream all by myself, and I don't get those feelings of loneliness. What changed?
Well, let me ask you before I throw that to our guest, Tom. I mean, what changed in your mind? What kind of thoughts were in your head when you were feeling lonely and drinking in that bar versus what's in your mind when you're out fishing?
Oh my God! When I was drinking, I'd be sitting there and there'd be all these people around, and I just feel like they don't care about me. I don't care about them. I just want that next drink, you know. And I could sit here in a social atmosphere, and hopefully, it'll be socially acceptable. Now I go out into a trout stream or out in the woods, and it's just not there. I don't feel that uselessness. I feel like things count. The world counts.
Tom, I'm really happy to hear that. Congratulations. Keep it up, man. That is great. Amit, what kind of things do you hear there?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for sharing, Tom. I have two thoughts that come to mind. One is we want to differentiate between loneliness and solitude. Solitude is the positive side of social isolation. Sometimes when we're socially isolated, especially when we're outdoors, we actually feel better. And there should be a very good distinction between the two. The second thing is we're talking about emotion regulation, right? What do people do to help them change their emotions? And drinking is definitely a form of emotion regulation. And, you know, for sometimes, and in some cases, it's actually helpful, you know, but in many cases, and in other cases, drinking is actually can be a form of emotion regulation that maybe achieves sort of the opposite effect. And so when I'm hearing you describing your experiences, I say maybe in that situation, drinking may be sort of a less helpful sort of form of emotion regulation. So, and you seem to have the good answer, right? Just go out, fish, and have a good time.
Thanks again for sharing that story, Tom. I appreciate it. At 800-642-1234. Let's go next to another Tom, this Tom in Middleton. Hi, Tom.
Hi there.
What did you want to bring up, Tom?
Well, I want to bring up the blues. The blues it's a way of feeling better. It's a strategy for feeling better. Intuitively, you would think the blues, which are, if you look at the lyrics, they're sad. A lot of them are about loneliness. But it's the communitas. It's the community of imagined others having the same lonely experience that makes you feel better. Because you know so many other people are experiencing the exact same thing you are, or even worse. And so it's communal.
Tom, I love that. Can you, before we let you go, can you share a favorite go-to blues musician for you?
Etta James.
Excellent. Tom, thanks a lot for the recommendation and the idea. I mean, I love that he had this, you know, we're communing with others. We're realizing it's not just us in this situation.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful idea, and there's a lot of work that suggests that sometimes, and many times we don't want to be sad, but sometimes being sad or angry with other people makes us feel much better. And we have a lot of examples from our culture of situations in which we basically get together and feel sadness or sometimes anger. And these sort of communal experiences are actually contributing to our well-being. So not all negative experiences are bad. And definitely sometimes feeling bad with other people makes us feel good. It's kind of an irony, but it's true.
Tom, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about the ways we deal with our negative emotions, specifically loneliness. And there are techniques. Our guest has shared some of them to help us change the way we think about a situation and hopefully maybe break out of that loneliness. Amit Goldenberg stays with us, psychologist at the Harvard Business School. Amit, it seems like one challenge here is even if we recognize the techniques of reappraisal and how they can work, when we are in that negative spiral, sometimes it's hard to have that self-awareness to see that we're in it in the first place and know that we need a new technique. How do we get there?
Yeah, absolutely. And so there, you know, one interesting finding in the emotion and emotion regulation literature is that people who are older are happier. That's also kind of counterintuitive. Usually younger people, usually we think of older people as sort of grumpy and unhappy, but that's actually not true. They're in fact also less lonely on average than younger people. And one of the questions is why? And one of the answers, and this is an answer by Laura Carstensen at Stanford, is that older people do a better job at choosing the situations that will make them feel happy. And so that's my advice in response to your question, which is one strategy that comes before reappraisal is trying to choose as much as possible or think about carefully as much as possible about the situations that you're choosing in your life and how these situations can make you feel. So seeing people that will make you feel better, going to places that will make you feel better, and that will make it easier for you to reappraise for sure.
Now, we've been in a pandemic for a long time. A lot of negative emotions, loneliness, just one of them. Is reappraisal just a short-term solution for negative problems, or is it something that in a sustained period like this of a lot of bummer news that can continue to help us?
Yeah, we have some evidence that teaching people or making or having people think consciously about reappraisal and understand its importance may have a long-term effect on people's well-being. It's sort of like it's teaching people sort of a very simple method that once become part of a habit can help people have sort of long-term benefits. And we have a lot of evidence from studies that show that these sort of small changes can make big differences if they're practiced enough.
Time for one more caller. Jill is with us in Bruce. Jill, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Jill? Yep, loud and clear.
I am in a situation where I live out in a rural area. I'm sorry, I'm in my car and
Oh, are you still there, Jill?
I don't have any family. I don't have any children. I don't have any family left. They've died. I have a little service dog, and I have a wildlife sanctuary, and it's very, a lot of times I just get, the area doesn't like that, but there's room for both hunting and wildlife. But I don't even have anybody like to bury me. So I would have to have somebody from long distance come. And so I do help other people. I don't want to say what I do for work, but it's what do you do on that one?
It's hard, Jill. Thank you for calling in. We just have a few moments left. Amit, sometimes, loneliness is imposed on us by our circumstance in life. Amit, how can we start to tackle that just in our last minute?
Yeah, Jill, thank you for sharing your feelings. Sometimes in life sort of things are harder sort of to reappraise than in other cases. What I would suggest is to start from, finding one person that you can feel close to, and hopefully that would make some changes in the way that you feel.
Jill, thanks for calling. Good luck to you. We're here with you. And Amit, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for sharing this research with us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That's Amit Goldenberg, assistant professor of business administration at the Harvard Business School, psychologist by training. He was with us today to share strategies for combating loneliness and how they can be used, especially during the pandemic. Coming up, the Winter Olympics kick off this week in China. The athletes are the center of attention, but so are international politics. We'll look at the controversies and human rights issues surrounding the Games. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.